In case you missed it, this episode is marked explicit. This is your chance to hit pause and come back later. If you don't want my opinion, episode 6, Me and That Train, by Carl Marking. I spent the summer between my sophomore and junior years of college working at Strawbridge and Clothier, a large regional department store. Dan was dating a girl I'd known since elementary school, Kathy. They had fallen quickly in love and were a couple of years into their relationship. It was clear to me she was the one for him, and he was the one for her. They spent most of their free time together, and Dan and I had begun to grow apart. I came home from work one day in June and got a phone call from a former teacher of mine from the community college, Miss Jennings. I had taken a course with her the year before, and she was the head of the college's theater program. She was barely 5 feet tall, had a nasal voice, a huge head of dark, curly hair, was moody as hell, and a complete force of nature. I liked her. "Hi, Carl. It's Wendy Jennings. I'm calling to see if you know about the summer children's theater camp I run through the college's drama program." "No, I don't." "Every summer we put on a show, and this year I'm combining the children's theater with the adult program, and I'm looking for as many people to audition as possible, and I'm hoping you'll try out." I was silent. Similar to the way making eye contact with myself in a mirror threatened a connection within myself that I wasn't ready to experience, being around children, the age I was, when I had been abused, was triggering. I had no understanding of that at the time. All I knew was that I was uncomfortable around young children, with no logical explanation. She interrupted my silence. "You'd be doing me a huge favor if you auditioned, but it's also a huge commitment. If you get cast, which I assume you will, rehearsals are 5 nights a week through July and start next week. Then we'll put on a varying number of shows in August, depending on how ticket sales go. Can I think about it and let you know?" "I'm sorry. I know it's a lot to throw at you, but the last auditions are tonight at 6. I looked at my swatch. It was 4:15. "I haven't sung formally in years," I said. "That's fine. We're looking for chorus members at this point. So you don't need to have anything prepared. They'll have you do scales and sing Happy Birthday or something, since you're not trying out for a main role. I'm sure you'll do great." Again, I was silent. "Please?" "Okay, Miss Jennings." "Terrific. Call me Wendy. You're not my student anymore." Then, almost as an afterthought, she said, "And wear something comfortable. There's a dance component to the audition. See you at 6. And she quickly hung up. Dance? What was I getting myself into? I was glad I didn't have much time to worry about it. The theater space was an old elementary school, between the apartment my mother had rented after my parents divorced, and the now vacant lot at the grocery store that had exploded. When I arrived, there were dozens of people milling around. I signed in, was called by the choreographer, and shown some dance steps, then sent in to the music director. I felt ridiculous, but everyone couldn't have been nicer. I was offered a role in the chorus and said, sure. Other than work, I had a lot of free time on my hands. When I arrived for the first rehearsal, there were over 50 people from all over the community, ranging in age from 8 to 60. I was standing directly between the entrance to the auditorium and the staircase up to the stage from the floor. Paul, who was both the music director and one of the leads, came into the auditorium from behind me. "Michael!" he shouted. "Has anyone seen Michael?" "Here I am," someone called from off stage. I looked up. Enter the faggoty bank teller Michael, stage left. I was 20, which made him 27. He was larger than life, knew most everyone in the room, and I couldn't stop staring at him as he walked toward me. "What are you staring at, kid?" he said with a friendly tone and a smile. I just kept staring. "Better close your mouth before a fly gets in." I snapped my mouth shut. "Keep your pants on, Paul, I'm coming," he said as he walked by me, and they both exited the auditorium. Holy shit. I was going to be in a show with the only gay man I knew, other than Pip, who was anywhere near my age. For as long as I could remember, my mother repeatedly mentioned Michael, using him as her consistent and negative example of all things wrong with being a faggot, and as a result, he had become, for me, homosexuality personified. From the time I was in fifth grade, my mother had made his name a regular part of my life as I worked out my sexuality. He had become the only real-life benchmark I had for what it was to be a gay man. And as a result, he had taken on the unexpected status of gay role model. None of which occurred to me as I stared at him, slack-jawed, as he walked by me in the auditorium. I was instantly drawn to him because of the symbol he had become in my life, and I realized I was also afraid of him. I would be in his presence 5 days a week for most of the summer. What if he actually saw me? The real me? The me I was still simultaneously hiding and coming to understand. I was afraid he'd see things in me even I didn't see. As rehearsals began, no one cared about anyone's orientation, marital status, career, or finances. Everyone just wanted to perform, entertain, or help make it all happen. I felt I'd found a special place to belong. There was no shortage of hard work, opportunity, talent, or egos. But it felt like a safe space, and safe spaces were rare and precious to me. Paul and I developed a friendship as the summer unfolded. One night at rehearsals, I alluded to him that I was trying to work out whether or not I was gay. "I had a feeling," he said. "But at your age, I thought it better to let you disclose it to me rather than asking you directly. It's a delicate matter. I appreciate that. I'm still trying to figure it out. I mean, I've known forever, but I've also tried forever not to be. I'm not comfortable with it. It may not feel like it to you, but you're young and you have time to figure it out. If you are, you are. If you're not, you're not. If you ever have questions about it or need someone to talk to, I'm happy to help. For what it's worth, it's not easy to figure it out. It's never been easy." Paul never hit on me. He never said anything sexual or inappropriate to me. He didn't steer me one way or another. He just made himself available, one human being to another. He became both friend and mentor. We entered dress rehearsals, and everyone had to be in costume. The green room was the school's former kitchen, and there were no separate spaces for the women and men to change. Everyone changed in front of each other. Given my history, I struggled with body shame issues and was hesitant to undress in a room full of strangers. "There's no such thing as modesty in theater," someone said to me, correctly reading my hesitation. "You can either change in front of us, along with all of us, or step out into the side yard and change out there." I thought I'd take my chances and stepped through the side door out into the yard. Then there was Michael, having a cigarette, wearing shorts, shoes, and nothing else. He and a friend I'd gone through school with were tossing a football back and forth. The thought of changing in front of him was too much, and I went back inside. Paul, already in costume, was putting on his makeup and looked at my reflection in the mirror. "I see how you are around Michael," he said to me quietly. "I'll have to tell you about that someday," I said. "If you're really uncomfortable, go change in the bathroom. You won't be able to do that during a performance, so you're going to have to get out of your head and jump in with the rest of us." After rehearsal, I joined a bunch of the cast at a local bar. I sat at a table with Paul and a few other people from the show. He leaned into me. "Spill it," he said softly. "What's the deal with you and Michael?" There, in the middle of a crowded bar, I told him the story of how Michael had appeared in my life in fifth grade, what my mother had called him all the years in between, how he'd become a symbol to me of what it was to be gay, and how all of that made me painfully awkward around him. "Wow, no wonder you had that look on your face that first night. You noticed? Everyone noticed." I blushed. "Including Michael. Great. He likes you, you know." "Really? He's asked me about you a couple of times." He and Michael had apparently been friends for many years. "He's in a relationship, isn't he? With that old guy?" Paul chuckled. "Yes and no. What does that mean?" "There are many kinds of relationships in this world. Sometimes you're exclusive with your partner, and sometimes you're not. They love each other, live together, but because of the age gap, Michael has the freedom to fool around with other people." "I could never," I said and looked away, thinking about what Paul had just said. My gaze, with no conscious intention, landed directly on Michael, who looked me in the eyes, raised his beer, and took a long drink without breaking eye contact. Paul watched the whole thing and let out a hearty laugh. "Of course you couldn't." "I have a favor to ask," Paul continued. "After the show is over, Wendy and I are going to the beach for 2 weeks, and I need someone to house sit for me. Will you still be around, or will you have left for college? I'll be around. How about it? House sit for me? I'll give you $30 a week and leave the fridge stocked. Sure, why not? It'll be nice to get out of my house and be on my own. Paul rented a small house just outside town. I arrived mid-afternoon the Saturday he'd left for the beach and settled in. The place had a warm, thoughtful feeling, and I felt welcome as soon as I'd stepped through the door. Based on his movie collection and collectibles, he was clearly a Disney fan. He also collected Fiesta ware, and his kitchen was full of it. He had artwork, books, and plants everywhere. There was a note on the fridge. Dear Carl, the fridge is stocked as promised. Please water the plants once a week. Feel free to watch any movie in my collection. I put out a few I thought you may like. The main number for the cabin where we're staying is on the fridge in case of an emergency. Don't have an emergency. I've also made a list of other numbers you may find helpful. Have fun. Paul. I scanned the list of numbers, and at the very end was Michael's. I knew Paul had told Michael I was house-sitting for him, but I didn't know if he'd told him anything else. I had direct, private access to Michael, and wasn't sure what to do with it. It took me several days to work up the nerve, and I called him that Wednesday. I was wondering if you'd like to come over some evening and watch a movie. How about tonight? He asked. Sure, I said, giving it barely another thought. Michael arrived, carrying a handful of movies, vodka, peach schnapps, and orange juice. As soon as I saw the liquor, I was instantly on edge. I knew it was because of my history with Pip, and did my best to let it go, but I could feel the tension in my body. The body remembers. We sat opposite the TV with our backs resting on the opposing armrests of the sofa. Our torsos were turned to face the screen. He's handsome, Michael said of one of the actors on TV. I could tell he was testing the waters. I'm partial to Kevin Costner, I said. Michael moaned his agreement. Have you ever seen the 1940s French version of Beauty and the Beast? He asked. No, I didn't know there was one. It's brilliant. The special effects are amazing for the time period. The main actor is beautiful. He was also the director's lover. He went into the kitchen and made us drinks. This is a screwdriver, he said and handed me a glass. I took a sip and set it aside. No good? It's good. I just have to get up early, I lied. In reality, my rape experience was bleeding into my time with Michael. I knew Michael better than Pip. I had spent 5 days a week in his presence for most of the summer, but Pip had taught me a painful lesson, and it left me hypervigilant. This is visually one of the best movies ever made. I'm so excited to introduce you to it. He put the tape in the VCR. It has subtitles, is that okay? Sure, I like foreign movies. We were both wearing t-shirts, shorts, socks, and were sitting with our legs folded under us. Michael extended his legs a bit toward me. I did the same, which left our legs overlapping, feet to calves. It was a beautiful movie. As we watched, he shared behind-the-scenes bits of information about the actors, how a scene was filmed, and how particular special effects had been achieved. Without looking away from the TV, he fully extended his leg and rested his foot on my inner thigh, halfway between my knee and groin. I didn't comment or pull away. A few seconds later, he moved his foot just a little further up. I still didn't comment or pull away. He was gauging whether or not each touch and position was welcome before proceeding with the next, which telegraphed to me that he was not interested in forcing anything unwanted to happen, which allowed me to relax and lower my guard. I took his foot in my hands and began to massage it, which was the most physical intimacy I'd had with anyone since my rape. You're a natural, he said. Eventually, he pulled his foot out of my hands and placed it on my inner thigh and waited. Again, I said nothing and didn't move away. Slowly, he slid his foot up my thigh to my groin and gently rested it there. He could feel my arousal. Would you like to do anything about that? He asked. I don't know. He held his hand out to me. I reached out and took it. We alternated back and forth between holding one another's hands and caressing each other's legs until the movie finished. There was a relaxed but palpable current flowing between us. Everything felt more intimate than anything Pip and I had done, other than our first kiss. Michael had only been aware of my existence for a couple of months. But for me, I felt as if this moment had been building since the first time I saw him 9 years earlier. My mother's regular, hateful commentary had woven Michael's existence into my life. Being on the sofa with him felt as if I was finally catching some train that had been running beside me for half my life. The movie ended. "What did you think?" he asked. "That was one of the most beautiful movies I have ever seen. Thanks for sharing it with me." "You're something else," he said. "How so?" "You're just not on the inside what you seem to be on the outside."
"What do you mean?"
"You're an old soul in a young person's body. You come off as if you're all surface, happy and glossy, but you're actually quite thoughtful."
"I've had an interesting life. I was forced to grow up faster than I would have liked."
He knocked my thigh with his foot and said, "Okay, how about this one?" And held up The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. "Well, I know of the books, but I've never read them or seen the movie. It's fun, and no subtitles." He got up to change the tape and stepped outside to have a smoke. I couldn't maintain my twisted position any longer and stretched out on the sofa. When he came back, he hit the start button on the VCR before heading over. I started to sit up to get out of his way, but he reached out, put his hand on my shoulder, and gently pushed me back down. "Make room," he said and almost sat on my lap. I quickly rolled onto my side and pushed myself back into the sofa. He sat down at my waist, and as he lay down in front of me, he slid one of his legs between mine. We lay there, with our legs entwined. He eventually took my arm and tucked it low around his waist, then draped his arm on top of mine. We spooned together as we watched the movie. He wasn't wearing cologne, and smelled of cigarettes, soap, and Michael. We quickly found ourselves in our underwear and socks. We were facing one another on the sofa. I once again felt as if my life had been leading up to this moment with this person. And I kissed him.
"Okay," he said, and pulled away. "That won't do."
"Do I have bad breath?"
"No, but let's talk about the kissing."
He proceeded, as kindly as possible, to give me a crash course in embouchure and tongue usage.
"Now, let's try that again," he said, and initiated a kiss.
Much better. We made out on that sofa for the next 5 hours, the only light provided by the static of the TV screen. When he produced a condom, seemingly from thin air, I froze.
"I'd like you to use this on me," he said.
I don't know. My experience with Pip flooded my nervous system. He looked at me patiently. Or I should say, I don't know how. He stood up, offered me his hand, which I took, and led me into the bedroom. He was tender, patient, respectful, and showed me everything I needed to know. It was exactly how I imagined it should be. The first light of dawn was blooming as he left to go home. As I showered, my emotional state began to shift. I began to feel as if I'd done something dirty and taboo. I felt soiled. I began accusing myself that I'd done to Michael exactly what Pip had done to me. Michael was a willing participant, guide, and teacher, explaining to me step by step exactly what to do and how to do it. We also both enjoyed the experience, which made it profoundly different from Pip forcing himself on me. But the damage Pip did had taken up residence in my body. It took conscious effort for me to separate my experience with Pip and what he took from me, from my experience with Michael and what we shared with one another. Weeks before I left for Towson, I decided to confide in two other friends that I was gay, Elroy and Jonah. Elroy and I became friends in third grade. He was an only child and lived in our neighborhood with his mother and her boyfriend. He led what seemed to me to be an isolated life. He was awkward around other kids, raw and wary. He was skinny, dark-haired, blue-eyed, deeply freckled, and quiet. He always seemed just a bit out of place, which, given what I'd been put through the prior 2 years, resonated with me. He was unflinchingly always himself, which often made him a target for harassment and bullying. He knew he was different, and didn't show any interest or ability in changing, something I deeply admired about him. The majority of my friends were boys, while Elroy's were mostly girls. At recess, he'd often be off with the girls playing Chinese jump rope or whatever game was popular. It registered with me at the time that he was somehow different, but I didn't care. He was good-natured, smart, funny, introspective, and sincere.
I needed people around me who were the same on the outside as the inside. We would study together and often ate lunch together at school. He had a very strict home life. Something had happened to his birth father. I don't know if he had left them or had died. Elroy never talked about him. By the time we met, his mother was with another man, Rupert. She was timid and shy, like Elroy, while Rupert, who was ex-army and the son of a southern reverend, was all swagger and bravado. He had no idea how to handle Elroy any more than my father, who was ex-navy, knew how to handle me, which gave Elroy and I a lot of common ground to explore. Our friendship was oddly insular. When we'd hang out together, it was always just us, and almost always inside at his house. He wasn't allowed out very much unless for school. I don't recall him ever coming to my house to play, and given he was somewhat effeminate, it was for the best. My family would not have been kind to him. I'd go to his house, and we'd watch cartoons or play board games in his room. We played a lot of chutes and ladders. It was his favorite. We talked about almost everything. I never told anyone about being pimped out. Based on my mother's reaction to the news I had once fooled around with a peer, I couldn't imagine how she'd react to that news, though I was sure it would somehow be my fault. I can't point to a specific moment between us that warranted the solidification of our bond, but we bonded. Toward the end of fourth grade, his family moved away. We wrote letters to each other every week for almost a year, and then he stopped writing without explanation. The summer between sixth and seventh grade, my brother had been forced to take me with him to see The Empire Strikes Back. As I looked for somewhere to sit that wasn't near my brother, I saw him. Elroy? He looked toward me, and recognition slowly dawned in his eyes. Are you back? For good? My stepfather got a job here, so we're back. Rupert? Yeah. He had grown taller and otherwise looked almost exactly the same. We caught up with each other as we waited for the movie to start. They had moved into the apartments on the edge of my neighborhood, a few streets away from my house. We promised each other we'd connect. We hung out that summer, but something had changed. There was a heaviness to his spirit, as if something had been taken from him. Whatever it was that had happened left him closed off and guarded. Seventh grade began, and ever since I looked up homosexual in fifth, I was desperately trying not to be one. But Elroy didn't seem to care what people thought, and he was himself at all times. In eighth grade, once I developed my crush on Bobby, and following Milton and my experiences with a guidance counselor, I pulled away from Elroy. I was worried of guilt by association. In high school, Elroy and I were in concert and marching band together, and as I continued to try to understand my sexual orientation, he seemed at peace with his. We never spoke about it. Never. I had the luxury of being able to pass as straight, but he did not. Rupert had become a band booster and was around all the time. He openly displayed his disdain for Elroy's mannerisms and tore him down every chance he had. As a result, Elroy didn't receive much bullying from other kids. I think they were so stunned by his stepfather's behavior toward him, they collectively decided to give him a pass. He developed an obvious crush on a male bandmate and upperclassman. And because I was more worried than ever about the potential for guilt by association, I all but completely pulled away from him. I was a coward, while he did his best to live his life as his authentic self. After high school, when we weren't under the social microscope of an entire student body, we reconnected, and the core of our friendship was still intact. I had bought a car, and we would go on drives together, listening to Broadway soundtracks as we talked about theater shows and movies. It was as if there were unspoken agreements between us that we would not talk or ask about each other's childhood, family, or sexuality. I felt in my soul we had more in common than either of us wanted to admit on all three fronts. Perhaps we instinctively knew we had a shared history of abuse, and because neither one of us had the tools to discuss it openly, we kept that door closed. Having decided I wanted to tell Elroy I was gay, I gave him a call. I don't remember what we did that day. But when we got back to his folks' place, I turned off the car before he got out. He turned and looked at me expectantly. I think I may be gay, I said. May. I still wasn't ready to fully commit. I'm moving, he replied. What? That wasn't the response I had anticipated. Why? Things are not good with him, and he nodded toward his house and was referring to his stepfather. Still not looking at me, he said. I need to get out.
Where are you going?
I have friends in D.C., he said, and turned to look out his window toward the interstate.
When are you leaving?
As soon as I can.
I don't know what to say.
He looked at me.
You're being silly thinking you may be gay. If you're gay, be gay. And get out of here if you can't be who you are.
I am. He shifted his gaze toward his house, put his left hand on my right forearm, gave it a long, gentle squeeze, opened his door, got out of my car, and went inside without another word. I never saw him again.
Jonah, who I'd met through all-county band in high school, was my age and also headed to Towson in the fall. He had dark blonde hair, was of average height and build, had beautiful light blue eyes, a gentle spirit, and a tender heart. I developed a crush on him the first time we played in band together and believed he was also gay, for no other reason than he was a gentle soul, never talked about girls, and I wanted it to be true. We had just finished bowling and were back in the parking lot of the local Kmart where I'd picked him up earlier. We'd been hanging out in my car talking for over an hour. As I braced myself to tell him, my body temperature suddenly fell, just as it had that evening at the racetrack. I felt sick to my stomach, my mouth went dry, my teeth began chattering, and my legs were shaking.
Before you go home, I want to tell you something. I think I'm gay.
A lot of adolescents feel mixed up about their sexuality, he said.
I was taken aback on two fronts. First, I had misjudged what his response would be. Second, it was the most intelligent thing I'd ever heard him say. But it wasn't at all what I'd expected or wanted to hear. I was absolutely certain he'd say the same thing back, and had imagined my disclosure would end up in some amazing makeout session there in the parking lot.
My mother always tells me to take my friends where I find them, he continued, so that's okay with me.
I had a great time. I should be getting home. Let's get together again and catch up before the fall semester. How cool is it that we're going to the same college?
He got out of the car, waved goodnight, and drove away.
That fall, I started my junior year of college at Towson University. Move-in day was uneventful, and I met my roommates for the first time. Dick had dark hair and eyes, a solid frame, and played football. Mark was fair-skinned with light eyes and hair. He was both a swimmer and on the lacrosse team. The three of us were not well-matched. I was not muscular, but had kept my weight off and had grown another inch. I was now 6'4" and broad-shouldered. Dick took one look at me and asked, "What position did you play in high school?"
"Mellophone," I answered.
He looked confused. "I was in marching band."
"What's your major?" he asked.
"Secondary education, mathematics."
"Good. You can keep supporting the team by helping me with my math."
That was who he was, endlessly assessing what others could do for him and assuming they would do it. As the last to arrive, I got the leftover bed, closet, and desk. I began to unpack and made my bed. The Garfield bedsheets I had purchased, ironically, suddenly seemed unwise. When it came time for dinner, Dick and Mark ate with their teammates. I went to the dining hall, and while looking for a place to sit, I heard a girl call my name.
"Susan? I didn't know you were going here."
We'd been in high school band together, and she had graduated 2 years before me.
"Jonah, what are you doing in our dining hall?"
"There is a mix-up, and I'm living in this dorm now," he said, a bit annoyed.
"Sit down," Susan said.
"This is Sarah, my friend and roommate." We spent the next few hours sharing stories and getting to know each other. Susan was short, with long dark brown hair, and carried a few extra pounds. Sarah was trim, with long, thick, dirty blonde hair and rosy cheeks. As we ate dinner and got to know each other, I could feel the connections forming between the four of us. The next morning was the first day of classes, and I met Joy for coffee next to the university's bookstore. We had become friends at the community college. She was about 16 years older than me, and it had been at her suggestion that I applied to Towson, majored in education, and applied for the scholarship that made it possible for me to be there.
"Hello," she called out as she entered the building.
I waved back.
When she reached the table, I said, "Good morning. Where's the beach?"
"Funny," she said. "Remember how you said you wanted me to help you blend in with the younger students? My first piece of advice is, that bag has to go."
"I think it's nice," she said defensively.
"It is, it's just working against you."
"What do you suggest?"
I pointed to my book bag on the floor next to me.
I thought about that, but I didn't want to look like I was trying too hard.
Your canvas bag may as well read, "Victim here, victim here." "Hey," she said. A book bag will also help you distribute the weight of the books as you're walking from the parking garage to your classes. Well, that's true. We went into the bookstore and I helped her pick one out. In exchange for my time and having her back, she bought me a muffin, which became our tradition for the rest of the semester. We'd meet each morning when she was on campus, have coffee, study, and she'd buy me a muffin. Later that day, I was walking across campus between classes. "Carl, hold up!" a guy called out to me and sprinted to catch up. "I didn't know you were going here," he said. He was a skinny guy about my age, tan, with spiky, light brown hair and pale blue eyes. I had no idea who he was and gave him a blank stare. "It's Ray." Still nothing. "From high school." Total blank. "I'm Dan's friend. Geez, we went through like 4 years of school together and you don't remember me?" "No, I don't." He seemed genuinely hurt. "I don't know many people on campus," he continued. "If you ever want to get together, here's my number." And he sprinted off to wherever it was he'd been going when he first saw me. Given I didn't know many people on campus either, I decided to call him. We met up and walked around campus. He was dating a girl Elroy used to play with in elementary school. She and Elroy had once tried to teach me Chinese jump rope in third grade, but I couldn't get the hang of it. It turned out Ray knew most everyone I'd known my entire life. I couldn't figure out how I didn't know this guy existed. "Do you know how to play racquetball?" he asked. "No, but I've always thought it looked fun. Want me to teach you?" "Sure." He made a reservation for a campus court, taught me how to play, and proceeded to wipe the court with my ass. We laughed the entire time, and in that one game, our friendship was formed. When I got home that first weekend, I called Michael. He invited me over to his house to hang out with him and his partner. I didn't know what the protocols were for hanging out with a couple when having sex with one of them, so I called my only resource. "Paul, what do I do? This is completely out of my experience. Go over, hang out, see what happens. What if Hallie gets angry with me? What if Hallie wants to have sex with you?" "I hadn't thought about that." "You should." I imagined what that would be like. Hallie was easily 20 years older than Michael, and the thought of having sex with him made me uncomfortable. I didn't find him at all attractive. "Look," Paul continued, "I've known both of them a very long time. This is how they've chosen to structure their relationship. If you want to fool around with Michael, you're going to have to learn how to navigate Hallie, and you need to figure out what you want and what your boundaries are." My problem with Paul's approach was that my abuse had left me a people pleaser with no boundaries around sex. "The sex with Michael was too good not to see him again," I said. "I heard." "Really? What did you hear?" "Everything." "Oh, God. I'm hanging up now." I got showered, dressed, and headed for Michael and Howie's place. I had never been to a gay couple's house before. To be gay and live with your partner in my town, it just wasn't discussed, so I had no idea what to expect of them or their home. When I arrived, Howie answered the door. "Michael's in there," Howie said and motioned toward the living room. The living room had a sofa, coffee table, large TV, and two upholstered chairs, one at each end of the sofa. The walls were lined floor to ceiling with bookshelves jammed with movies, books, and collectibles. "Hi, Carl. Have a seat," Michael said and patted the sofa next to him. "What are you drinking?" "Soda or water is fine." When I fantasized about finally exploring a relationship with another guy, this was not what that looked like. I was beyond uncomfortable and did not fully understand my motivation in being there. My years-long fascination with Michael was certainly the foundation of it, but I'd be lying to myself if I didn't acknowledge it was also little more than being 20 years old and finally being able to explore consensual sex with a man. I did my best to ignore the Howie factor, both because I didn't comprehend their relationship, and ignoring it was conducive to my goals. Denial is a powerful coping mechanism. Michael picked out a movie for us to watch, All About Eve, starring Bette Davis. At some point during the movie, Howie left the room and went down the hall toward the bedrooms. When the movie ended, Michael stood up and held out his hand to me. I took it and followed him down the hall. "I sleep in here," he said and opened one of the doors. "You don't sleep together?" "Sometimes, but not usually." I was confused, but relieved. The fact they had separate bedrooms made me feel less of an interloper and less guilty. Paul had told me this was how they structured their relationship. I'd just never seen, read, or heard about this kind of arrangement. When we finished, we made small talk. Then I got dressed and went home. As I brushed my teeth to go to bed, I discovered a hickey. "What's that on your neck?" my mother asked the next morning. "A hickey," I said. "I can see that. Who gave it to you?" I didn't respond, which was new for me. Normally, when she asked me a question, I felt positively compelled to answer. But what was there to say? A lie? I felt as if all I'd done since eighth grade was lie about who I was. I was sick of lying. "You look ridiculous," she said and left the room. When I got back to campus, Dick noticed it right away and started writing me about it. He reminded me in all the bad ways of my brother. I never felt comfortable in Dick's presence, and my inability to feel at ease in my own room began to eat at me. Mark, on the other hand, just did his own thing and focused on school. During that first month, Ray and I became best friends, drinking buddies, squash partners, and confidants, mostly. We'd sometimes hang out with his girlfriend at their place. The three of us would drink, eat our fill of Ivan's spiced wafer cookies, and be young together. But their relationship was obviously unraveling, and it was painful to watch. Also during that first month, my clique of four friends had grown to a pack of nine, one of whom, Virginia, had developed a crush on me. Sarah and Susan kept pushing us together and made it clear to me that they expected me to ask her out, and when I wouldn't, they would arrange scenarios that left Virginia and I alone together. "You're not seeing anyone," Susan or Sarah would say. "Why won't you just ask her out?" "Because I'm not interested." "But she really likes you." They would say this as if the fact of her liking me was the basis for some contract that demanded I reciprocate the feeling. When I didn't, they made me feel as if I were somehow being callous or actively rejecting her, which made me feel guilty, which made me want to tell them why I wasn't interested, which made me feel afraid of being rejected, which made me feel like a shitty friend, which made me feel ashamed. I wasn't interested in Virginia, and oh yeah, I was probably gay. Because I was such a pleaser, I felt guilty about keeping my thoughts about my sexual orientation a secret. I had been raised that keeping secrets was equivalent to lying, while simultaneously being raised to keep any number of family secrets. The secret of my brother, the secret of my father's alcoholism, the secret of an affair I knew he was having years before my parents divorced. Jonah already knew my secret, and I worried if he'd keep it. Ray was taken to the ER that weekend. He was out drinking and someone slipped something into his drink. He passed out in the parking lot, someone found him right away, and he was taken to a hospital. He was lucky he wasn't mugged, or worse. "Motherfuckers probably wanted to harvest my organs or something," he said when he told me the story. I met Joy for coffee that Tuesday before class. "I'm struggling," I told her. "How do you mean?" "With school, with my roommate. He's such an asshole. I'm not sleeping. I just feel like I'm unraveling somehow, and I'm worried I'm going to lose my scholarship." What I thought was, I don't feel safe in my space, and oh yeah, I'm having sex every weekend with a man who's 7 years older than me, who is in a relationship with another man old enough to be my father. I don't understand why I'm not succeeding. I'm doing great in my education classes, and for the prior 2 years, I did great in my computer science and math classes, but I've fallen so far behind in calculus, I don't know how to pull up, and we're halfway through the semester. I shouldn't have taken so many credits. I looked out the window and thought, and I'm going into a career where I'll have to live a lie the rest of my life. Can I help? If it's the subject matter, I can figure out a way to spend more time here and tutor you. Joy was always so generous to me with her time and energy. That would be great, thank you. As for the rest, I can't figure it out. Have you thought about going to the counseling center? Maybe you just need to talk to someone. It's a big adjustment from commuting to a junior college to living on campus at a university. From what you've said in the past, your roommate situation isn't the best. I'll think about it. At least let me buy you a muffin, she said. I went home that weekend to see Michael. On my way to his place that Saturday night, I stopped at the drugstore to buy condoms. I was embarrassed to buy them. If you can't buy condoms, then you shouldn't be having sex, I said to myself. The hell with that, I said back. I'm definitely having sex. And I grabbed a box and went to the pharmacy counter to check out. The person turned around and it was Will Haggerty. I could feel the color drain from my face, and my heart began to pound in my chest. "Hey, aren't you Carl? We used to live in the same neighborhood." I knew exactly who he was. He was the last kid my brother tried to pimp me out to. After the arrangement was made, I had my moment at the ice cream truck, and it never came to be. "I know who you are. I'm glad you remember me." "How could I forget?" I thought. "Looks like you're going to have fun," he said and winked at me as he rang up the condoms. "Take my number," he said and wrote it on the receipt. "Call me sometime." Call him sometime? I didn't know how to process that moment. This was the first time I'd run into anyone other than my brother, even remotely connected to that trauma. I left the store and headed to Michael's. Someone new was there. "Hey, Carl, this is Ken," Michael said. "Hello. We've actually met," I said. "Have we? Your father is my pastor." This was beyond weird. "We met at church one Christmas a couple of years ago. I wouldn't expect you to remember me." Ken was my brother's age, and for the second time that evening, I found myself feeling confused. Why was someone else here? Why hadn't Michael told me someone else was going to be here? It was weird enough with Hallie being here, and it was his home. Selfishly, I didn't know what Ken's presence meant for my plans with Michael. "How do you two know each other?" I asked. "The theater," Michael offered. I stood in the doorway between the kitchen and living room, deciding if I should stay or go. Hallie was in the upholstered chair to my right, nursing a drink. Michael was at the far end of the sofa from me. Ken was in the armchair to his left. They were doing shots of Jack Daniels with potato chip chasers. "Take off your jacket," Michael said. "What are you drinking?" "Water." I was still afraid to drink around people I didn't know or trust. "Help yourself," Howie said and motioned to the kitchen. He was glowering at Ken behind his tinted wire-rimmed glasses. I went into the kitchen and put my jacket on the chair closest to the door. I was already thinking of the fastest way out if I needed it. I got a glass of water and entered the living room. "Sit down," Michael said and patted the sofa cushion next to him. Ken was watching me intently, assessing me. I got the clear feeling he knew all there was to know about my situation with Michael. "What happens here stays here," Ken said and threw back a shot of JD, following it with a potato chip. What was going to happen here? Was that an invitation or a warning? His comment both aroused me and made me uncomfortable. "We're just about to watch a movie," Michael said and picked up the remote for the VCR. "Have you ever seen the movie Heavy Metal?" "No." "It's an animated adult movie and cult classic," he said and hit play. Howie stood up, drink in hand, crossed the room, and went down the hall to his bedroom without saying a word. The movie began. I couldn't figure out what their situation was, which caused me to wonder for the first time exactly what my situation was with Michael. I drove home confused. In a span of 5 hours, I met someone who reminded me of one of the worst periods of my childhood and had an odd run-in with my pastor's son at my gay lover's home. When I got back to school Sunday evening, Ray looked like shit and told me he'd been in a car accident. He drove an old Fiat Spider convertible. "I'm lucky to be alive," he said, and looked every bit the part. "What happened?" "I was coked up," he said and stopped talking. He hadn't meant to say that. "I thought you gave that up." "I'm trying," he said, and started to shake. I went over to him and hugged him. "You're the only person who accepts me for who I am," he said, and suddenly hugged me back. "You never ask me to change. You never give me shit for my behavior. You just..." And he searched for the next right words. "Love you," I said. "I just love you." "Yeah, you do. I love you too." And he gave me another big squeeze. We ended our hug and stepped away from each other. So what the hell happened? He took a deep breath and told me that while high on coke, he was driving too fast. A deer crossed the road in front of him. He lost control trying to avoid it and rolled the car. He ended up locked in place by the seatbelt, his convertible wrapped around a tree. He pulled up his shirt. Holy shit! He had a dark bruise in the exact outline of his seatbelt. I hit the tree so hard, I shit my pants from the force of the belt against my gut. We looked at each other solemnly, then simultaneously burst out laughing. "Okay, that's not really funny," I said. "No, no, it's not," he said, getting himself under control. "The car is probably totaled. I really am lucky to be alive." That week, I started writing Ray a letter. I worked on it when Mark and Dick were out of the room, and kept it stashed in the back of my desk drawer, along with my journal and a recent letter I'd gotten from Paul. We wrote to each other every week. Ray's comment about me being the only person in his life who accepted him made me want to let him know about my struggle with my sexual orientation. I wanted him to know me, and I desperately wanted his acceptance for who I really was. Given my past attempts to tell someone face-to-face had not gone as expected, I thought a letter would yield a better result. My plan was to give it to him before we went home for Thanksgiving, so we could talk about it over the break. As I gave more thought to what my life would be like as a gay man in public education, my interest in being a teacher declined. I couldn't see the point in going through so many years of soul-searching, only to end up back in the closet I was trying to escape. My grades continued to slip, and I withdrew from one of my math classes. The tension between Dick and I had become intolerable. I needed help and made an appointment with the college's counseling center. There was so much stigma around mental health care, it was not an easy decision for me to reach. I didn't expect to find allies, and I didn't like making myself vulnerable, but I was having suicide ideation again, and the stakes were too high. My scholarship was my one shot at getting through college, and I couldn't afford to fuck it up. Bringing myself to make the appointment was almost as difficult as walking through the door for my first session, which they canceled as soon as I walked in. "I'm sorry, we're overbooked. The holidays. We can't see you until the week after Thanksgiving. But if you need to be seen, we can refer you to psychiatric services so you could be seen this week." I didn't like the sound of psychiatric services. I could hear my mother that morning in eighth grade. "Are you a faggot? Because if you are, we need to get you fixed." I didn't need fixing. I needed support. "Fine," I told the scheduler. And they set up an appointment for the following day with psychiatric services. The doctor I saw alienated me instantly and completely. She kept interjecting her feelings and opinions during our session, rather than asking me questions and helping me identify solutions that worked for me. When it became clear she had her own agenda, I shut down and let her lecture me for the rest of my time. I didn't have the strength to leave, and sitting through it seemed the path of least resistance. That night, Susan and Sarah had a bunch of us over for pizza and beer. Ray and I arrived together, as we did for most things. Virginia proceeded to tell everyone there was a rumor going around that he and I were lovers. "What?" Ray asked. "That girl that's always making out with Dick in Carl's room? She's in one of my classes, and she told me." Virginia looked at Ray and I expectantly. We looked back. "Well, knowing you're not gay, I asked her what she meant by that. And she said Dick had found a letter in Carl's desk that proved you and Ray are lovers." I am so naive, I thought. Of course Dick was going through my things. "Well?" she asked.
"Well, what?"
I asked back.
"Are you two lovers?"
Epilogue. I've taken great care to remove various abuses I endured growing up from these episodes in an effort to stay focused on my coming out journey. But where there is overlap, where an abusive experience impacted my coming out, I felt I needed to leave it in. Being gay and being on the receiving end of abuse are often intertwined. The abuse can be violent or subtle and insidious. Milton and Elroy could not hide their true selves and were targets as a result, even from their own families. I was a tender soul, and for people of ill will, that was sometimes a magnet for abuse. There was a snowstorm one day when we were all still living together in my childhood home. My sister was outside shoveling, and I was inside baking cookies. A friend of our parents stopped by, and I overheard her remark to my mother, more than once, how unusual it was for her to find my sister outside shoveling and me inside baking. The reality was, my sister wanted to get away from our father and have time alone, so she chose to shovel the snow. Knowing she was in a bad place, I chose to bake her cookies. But the judgment that came from this woman was swift and entitled. She mentioned it for years to come. Gender role conformity can begin as soon as a fetus is sexed. Enter the gender reveal party, which usually has pink for girls and blue for boys. It can continue when a parent decides how to decorate a child's nursery and selects the child's first pieces of clothing. It can continue when parents divide chores among their children. Girls should do this, and boys should do that. Some people are fixated on gender roles and gender stereotypes to such a degree it is unhealthy and toxic. Feeling uncomfortable in my dorm room ate at every aspect of my being. The discord between Dick and I was a physical presence. I was incredibly naive to have thought my privacy would have been respected. But even with everything I had survived in my life, I was rather naive. I continued to operate from a place where I believed people were inherently good and could be trusted. The way Sarah and Susan kept forcing Virginia and I together was unkind to her. They approached the matter as if, because she liked me, and because I was single, I should like her back. As for Elroy, he did exactly what he told me he was going to do. He left, looking for the life he wasn't able to find within his family and hometown. Which is typically what happened when people came out at that time in history. If they couldn't, or feared they couldn't, find acceptance from family, friends, and their community, they left to be who they were in parts of the country or the world that were more supportive and accepting. 20 years after I dropped Elroy off that day, I went on a digital manhunt to find him. I did, and sent him the following message. Dear Elroy, I wanted you to know that I have thought of you often over the years. Your friendship, when we were young, meant the world to me. Playing games at your house, writing letters when you moved away, reconnecting when you moved back. I had so much going on at home when we were young, and I regret I was never able to share any of it with you. I didn't have the language for it, but I often felt we shared similar struggles. I wish I'd been a better friend to you then. In high school, I always admired you for being yourself. I know it cost you. I was struggling with my own sexual identity and pulled away from you when you probably needed a friend most. I remember that time we chatted in my car and I shared with you that I may be gay. I was still getting comfortable with the idea. I didn't realize that would be the last time I'd ever see you, and I wanted to take the time to let you know. I wish things had gone differently that day and throughout our friendship. I want you to know I admired your courage. I want you to know you made a positive impact on my life. I want you to know I'm glad we knew each other. I didn't get a response. After a couple of weeks, I assumed he was either no longer using that account or didn't want to connect with me. Then I received a reply. Carl, thank you for reaching out to me all these years later. I haven't had a very good life. Things have not gone well for me. It is incredibly difficult for me to think about my childhood. People from school have reached out to me from time to time, and you're one of the few I've responded to. I wanted to say thank you for letting me know you got something positive out of our friendship, and to ask you to let me go. It's too painful for me to connect with those years and anyone from them. I wish you the best. It was a difficult thing to read. I knew the truth of it. I saw firsthand how some of the difficulties in his life had unfolded. I regretted I wasn't able to be there for him in more meaningful ways, and I understood. I also cut strings to most of the people from my childhood for exactly the same reason. Maintaining relationships with people who connected me to that time in my life was just too painful. I didn't reply to his note, per his wishes. I have empathy for his journey, and respected his ability to know his limits and to have set that boundary with me. Boundaries do not come easily to abuse survivors. So I let him go in life, but still keep him in my heart.